get started.
Right next to us.
Okay.
While we were settling in, I should have given everyone green and blue chart of their housing occupancy. Shortly after Dr. Ransdell arrived, he, as he said, he toured many parts of the campus and realized that a lot of our campus was in great need of respect. And one of the many creative things that's been done under his leadership, the Student Life Foundation. You'll hear more from Brian Cooper about that in the construction update later on. But our resident halls, like most others on state campuses throughout the nation, had been built primarily in the 60s and were at least 30 years old and in need of repair. Brian will tell you in greater detail that this, we are wrapping up the completion, the primary completion of having renovated every resident hall room on Western campus. There's no other school in the state that can say that. They may have a new resident hall, but they do not have new resident halls. We're very proud that we have made this completion. It's all been done through our Student Life Foundation. Sometimes there is a negative behind great success. What I've passed out to you is where we are standing in our resident hall occupancy for the coming fall. We do a occupancy report the last day of the month and on the 15th, and the housing office is working on that report right now. I got a preliminary this morning. If we open today, we would probably have 25 beds vacant. That is really, really tight. And our budget is based on what occupancy?
4,590.
Okay. So that will let you know that a great portion of what the issue is today is our returning students keep wanting to come back. And that is a phenomenal success in resident halls to find older students wanting to return to the resident hall. Usually after the freshman year, students go home and their primary goal for the summer is to convince mom and dad to let them get an apartment. I realize that the economy has impacted some of this, but if you look throughout our community, you'll see a lot of independent resident halls, college student type housing that's available. Yet our students are saying they want to come back and live on campus. We are in the process of releasing the sophomore obligation so that we can create more beds for upcoming freshmen, because we still have, Dean, how many ATPs are left?
Three
left.
Yep.
And so we're in the process of inviting older students to go ahead and counsel and move off campus so that we can make sure that we accommodate all of our first-year students. It's a great question. Problem to have. Yes, sir.
Is that going to be for next year then?
I'm talking about this fall.
Oh, this fall. So sophomores this fall would not be required to live on campus?
Did not say that.
Okay. That's what I'm just trying to figure it out.
We are notifying sophomores, and I've asked Brian and Kit Tobler to make an emphasis on those students. The first students we approach need to be those with the highest academic standard. And we're approaching them in those GPA categories, more or less. Brian tells me we'll get through the entire sophomore class. But we will be telling them that this year, because of the need for beds, that we're going to give them an early release. What I don't want to convey is that we have removed our sophomore required housing policy. Come next year, I've got to spend a lot of time and effort in re-educating the public that that's not what we say. With me?
Yes.
Still look a little?
I got it.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Well, the fear is that we'll have incoming students, first-time students, freshmen, that if they can't get a residence hall, they decide that they need to go somewhere else just because mom and dad want to live on campus, or they want to live on campus. So we can't run the risk of having a disruption in our enrollment game plan for the class that's coming in this fall simply because of lack of housing occupancy. So temporary relaxing of that rule in a thoughtful way is one way to get at ensuring that we have sufficient space for the first priority of new students.
Right. And with the educational programs, things that go on in our resident halls, we're totally convinced that living in the resident hall experience is a positive experience, and those students with it enhances the student's grade point. We know that. Therefore, we want to look at those students that have shown the greatest success that they be the first that we approach. Some have already been approached, and I think Brian told me about 60 students have agreed that they're going to move off campus. We'll go on down the list and approach more. And we're also, of course, constantly look at contact those students that, according to our records, are returning sophomores but have not made their housing commitment. So if they're not returning to the university, we want to go ahead and be able to use that room immediately for an incoming freshman. Any other questions? I thank you all very much.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you, Howard.
The total number of beds available, is it 46?
49.
I mean 4960 or something like that?
4960.
That's got you, Jim. Yeah, thank you.
Take care of everything.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. We're now to the President's report.
Well, if you'll go to item 10.2, page 78. This is a fairly straightforward item, but it is only a interim step. I don't follow matters on a day-to-day basis that relates to whatever contracts we might have in place, but it was brought to my attention a couple of months ago that Dr. Seelig's contract ended on June 30. I think I became aware of that some week or two or three just before that. And so what we've done is we've extended that contract for 1 year, and we are working with Wood right now on a new contract, and we'll have that for you at the October meeting. But that's not something that you do in a casual or hurriedly put together manner. So this is what it is. It's an extension for a year, and we'll be back to you with a new contract for Dr. Seelig going forward.
I move to accept.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, Wood, you got 1 year.
Don't put any pressure on you, bud.
And Wood, if you will present 10.3, Jason Nidell.
Okay. Page 80 through 96, you have the employment contract for our head women's soccer coach. Jason Nidell is one of the few WKU head coaches without a multi-year contract. So this brings him up to that level. It's becoming pretty standard fare for the industry to have head coaches on multi-year contracts. So it really doesn't change much by way of compensation. for Coach Nidell. It does provide some performance bonuses, performance incentives for him that were previously unavailable. But he has been the only head coach that we have had for women's soccer at WKU. He has grown our program to the point where we compete for a Sun Belt Conference championship year in and year out. Outstanding student athletes on our women's soccer program. Just a fantastic coach for WKU women's soccer, and we thought that it was appropriate at this juncture to award him and offer him a multi-year contract. So you can see the contract before you, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Move to be approved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. So moved.
Thank you.
Thanks, Wood.
We have resolutions. We have prepared resolutions that you will find pages 97 through 101 for Ms. Liz Esters, Ms. Lois Gray, Ms. Forrest Roberts, and Ms. Tamla Smith. And we normally, if we had a single one, we might read the resolution before calling for your action. But in the interest of time and might find a little bit of repetition in these, all individuals most deserving of recognition from this board, all have served this university exceedingly well and thoughtfully, and I present these four resolutions from the former assistant in the president's office and board secretary, and three board members whose time on the board has now been complete. So I call these to your attention and ask for your approval.
Go second. Motion is second. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
And we will find proper ways to bestow these. I've invited Forrest. I'm speaking at the Owensboro Rotary Club in a few weeks. I've invited Forrest to join me. And there are lots of opportunities, obviously, for Tamla, but we'll get them also to Liz and Lois. If you'll trust us to find the right time and place and circumstance to do that. Information items, that's all the action items in my report. I want to turn our attention to some information items, and John and Tom and Robin and Wood have vowed to be brief in their presentations, so actually they maybe haven't, but I hope they just took the hint. Okay. So, floor is yours, John.
Well, if I'll direct your attention into pages 102 through 104 in your agenda book, that is the printed report that we traditionally provide to you at each of our quarterly meetings, where we list for you the projects that are ongoing with the university. As you will see, there's some $191 million in projects that are some level of planning, design, or construction. Or recently completed in this case. The last time I gave you one of these reports, it was in April at the April 24 meeting. It's been 90 days. I can tell you that in those 90 days, the university has been not only very busy, but very successful in progressing these projects along. I think you will see from your visibility on campus as well as this report, we're going to provide you some images. Go ahead, Jeff, and click on the snail. That we have made significant progress. First image is, you just came from this building, but I wanted you to see something. In all of our previous meetings, I've been giving you as a rendering of this building and what it was going to look like from this vantage point. Well, now it's no longer an architectural rendering of where we're going. This is the actual building and a photograph taken just a few days ago. Obviously, it must have been before we got some more rain, because I was noticing with Brian that that's really filled in nicely and recently. You've already seen the building. You've been to it. This is the entrance on your right, is the Engineering Biological Sciences Building in Thompson Center. That will be the entrance and the heaviest corridor for pedestrian traffic. And this is a shot taken from inside that stairwell looking out at that corridor. I think you've seen these visuals in the building already. And we talked to you at lunchtime about what this report was going to precede our tour, is what I thought. And I was going to give you a preview. We were real excited about what that might mean for us. Across the hall, across the street, rather, is the Science and Technology Hall, a project that has made significant progress since the last meeting. I have some shots here that indicate that you can see we're doing a complete renovation of this building, all the mechanical, electrical systems in the building. So this is a complete, from bottom up, renovation, which will become the home, of course, for the the math department in classrooms and office suites for the dean. It will be a renovation encompassing 59,000 square feet, $7.3 million, and even though it doesn't look like it at the moment, we are on schedule for a December completion, and we will be using this for the spring 2010 semester.
We're already planning a College High reunion in that building maybe this next spring, and since Lucinda Anderson is about the last known graduate of College High, we may just have her turn her loose on that reunion.
John,
you will recall that we have talked about the John. Meter. Oh, I'm sorry.
Quick question. It's on behalf of some faculty members from the math department. Have any funds been found for furnishings for the new STH?
Some.
We have. No. I'm not sure what the earmarks in the federal budget, science equipment, what buildings is that earmark money designated for? There's several million dollars in this federal budget for scientific equipment for Ogden College, and I'm assuming that that's going to be more than what we need for the new building and Science and Technology Hall, but I'm not certain of what the game plan is for that money, but it's several million dollars.
That's something we can find out. I just don't know.
Okay.
Bob, have you heard something that suggests that it's not being equipped?
Yes, I'm bringing this on behalf of the math faculty, who told me they'll be bringing the worn out and terrible furnishings right down to the desks from Thompson Complex with them when the building opens, and they're none too happy. So I bring it up.
I'd be surprised if that's the case.
And I'd be delighted if that was the case.
I don't think that's the case, but we'll check.
Van Meter Hall is a renovation project, again, a complete renovation of a 100-year-old building. It was constructed in 1909 and dedicated in 1910, so it's almost incredibly fitting and proper that 100 years later we're going to rededicate the building this spring 2010. That is the rendering of the building, where we are headed. Here is the shots that demonstrate the use of progress, where that is, the stage house, fly space referred to on the back of the building. Another interior shot of the lobby looking up at the second floor. This is taken from the balcony, looking, of course, at the stage area. The things I want you to notice here is that there's significant progress from previous meetings. There was a meeting like in January, and I think I showed this whole back of the building is completely open. We have cranes inside the building.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's significantly coming along. You see that the interior space is beginning to take shape.
Did you say what the target date was for completion?
Architect's completion, or the completion on that project, is December.
On Van Meter?
December of this year, we will use that facility in the spring.
Wow.
Great. Impressive.
Yes. Now, they have a contract that allows them to actually not finish it until June, I believe. But everything up to this point is putting that building on target for a December, probably.
Probably January would be my prediction.
Good.
But January would be, in my opinion, a substantial potential to let's take occupancy of the building. We have budgeted for a half a year of operation on the building. We're going to get to it. This construction company is very committed to their schedule. In Van Meter, just as a reminder, of course, there's going to be multi-purpose rooms, musical storage rooms, green rooms. The addition is 14,000 square feet, and the seating that will be in the facility once completed is 1,106 seats. So that will be the capacity for the renovated Van Meter. Here you see a recent shot of the Preston Health and Activity Center, where we're putting on a 14,000 square foot addition to the building, as well as we'll be conducting some renovation in some interior spaces. The $9.5 million renovation, including the 14,000 square foot addition. The addition will principally have cardio and weight room activities, but they'll also be spending some funding for interior renovations of the natatorium, office spaces, racquetball courts, and so forth. This building as well is scheduled for December, January completion, reopen for the spring term. Throughout the course of the year, we also conduct in the planning, design, construction department, looking at that like, what is that? This is simply a foreshot of a small project that's conducted by our planning, design, construction department. Over the course of the past year, they have completed 32 small projects on this campus that have made improvements of instructional space. Here is a before shot. Here's what it looked like when they got hurt. This is an example of a small project in an academic building. In this case, it's Academic Complex 316. And throughout the course of the year, I want you to realize that they do a lot of projects, in this case 32, totaling $531,000 in improvements on campus with various improvements of instructional space, entry doorways, those kinds of projects. Across the street, of course, is the construction site that we saw when we got on the bus. There'll be a day when I will click onto this. Instead of showing you an architectural rendering of this building, rather I'll show you where we are in terms of completion. But at the moment, this project is substantial and taking shape. Every day it seems to just come up out of the ground and continue to take shape. It's of course a $35 million project with 119,000 square feet of new construction for the College of Education, containing classrooms, offices, suite for the dean, of course. And it's scheduled for a November-December completion of 2010. So we will use this building if everything goes according to schedule for spring 2011 classes. At the end of December, some recent shots taken of their progress. We have a web camera on that building, and people can sort of just monitor it by going to it. To what website?
Owensboro.
Huh?
Owensboro.
Okay. What about this building? You need that also? Okay. Tess, where is that?
Is that the Kentucky? That's not Kentucky.
Okay, it's a setup on purpose.
I saw the diorama the other day.
It was a setup on purpose. This is an architectural rendering of what has been planned for the College of Business that we are seeking funding for from the General Assembly in the upcoming 2010-12 General Assembly.
Oh, that's great.
We are doing preliminary planning and programming for the project. We have not only selected the site, but we have done enough schematic planning and design to be able to start preparing visualizations, images, elevations, as it were, of what the building will look like as it's presently in design. At this point, this is taken, if you were a bird, I think, up above, looking at College Heights Boulevard. This is at the end of College Heights Boulevard, a few years back, it was renovated, and Van Meter, in a circle, 2 Van Meter straight.
So the Kentucky building's right to the...
Yes, to the left.
The left of that, yeah.
To the left.
Here's a look at what this building will look like under its present design.
If you just kept going around the bend on the right, you'd see the Kentucky building, right?
Correct. Or
you'd see the log house first.
If you kept going, you would see the log house and then the Kentucky building.
This shot's taken with your back to Kentucky Street looking up the hill of what the building would look like as its present design.
What is that? What's that substance, the white? What? It's not brick. What?
It's actually stone.
Stone?
It looks white, but it's a buff
the coloring
stone
for
color.
This rendering didn't come out right. It's actually going to be stone, and the color would, of course, be the same color of stone we've used on our other buildings.
Is that the existing?
This building is intended to complement the architecture of existing architecture on the campus.
Is that the existing parking lot? You've just kind of built it into the existing parking lot?
It's not there yet.
Or...
They would lose some.
There, but it doesn't look like that. So the parking lot's there, it just doesn't look like that yet.
This current plan along Kentucky Street. This entrance is off Kentucky.
That's impressive.
Just as a reminder, this is a $49 million project, number four on our priority list for the General Assembly session. And we are able to, as a result of the planning and work that's already gone into this, do a very good job of explaining how programmatically the building would serve the university, how instruction-wise and academically it would fit into the need for the university and the play space that's presently in Grice Hall that is, I think, basically not touched much since 1964. To give you a better idea of where this building is sited, this is looking down on the project with Van Meter in the bottom left hand corner. The circle I was referring to all ago, these buildings are facing each other as bookends with matching entry architecture. They're literally, as we I think I heard them call it, they're talking to one another. They're human. This would be a 120,000 square foot sizable building for the college business. It's a complete replacement for the college. Also currently in design and funded is a project to add an addition onto Fine Arts Center. That will be for instrumental and choral research space.
Hey, John, go back one more slide, please. Slide you just had up there. Go back. Point to the corner of center and 14. All right, that corner right there, the email you received from me a couple of days ago with the apparent changes by the Chapter 58 Corporation of the downtown parking garage, right there is where it's currently projected to go. A Marriott flag hotel will be right there called Spring Hill Suites. Probably take a university name, that will be factored in. An alumni center, conference center right here. This is a Sigma Nu fraternity house that will break ground in September, as I understand it. This one may or may not take place here, depending on how this alumni center gets set. But that is not a yet to be designated Greek house that probably will be moved down Center Street down here, but that's yet to be determined. But I just wanted to put in context for you the email you received from me a few days ago. That's the location. So we've gone from having a lease on a parking garage six or eight blocks from campus downtown here somewhere to right at our campus for the exact same lease. And if that happens, that is a home run for us.
Grand slam. Grand slam.
Yeah. Thank you. Here you go, John.
This is the first half of our report. This is a three-part report. I'm going to let Brian Russell, our director of Planning, Design, and Construction Department, walk you through some of the other projects that we are currently engaged in. And then Brian Coaster is going to give you an update that we talked about on our housing program. And then last but not least, I'm going to give you an update on the ESPC project.
We're going to start with the Adams Street parking lot. These parking lots were all funded with a $4 million budget. This parking lot runs along Kentucky and also Adams Street. What you see here is what they call your typical look. It's part of the sustainability. It's part of our stormwater management plan. What you're seeing is the undercutting of a, as we typically would call it, a retention area. But in this design, it's actually a detention area. And you'll see that these pipes or vessels that are being placed underground are where the water is stored from runoff that typically would go to our streets and go and just rush down the hill. This gives a large area underneath a parking lot area that will be storing the water, filtering the water, slowly releasing that water. Over the top of this area that we have, I'll go back, that gets filled with gravel, and then we have pervious, which means lets the water flow through concrete over the top of this area. That makes for a very environmentally, and then our storm runoff water that's collected off this large parking lot that's going to have about 497 spaces. It cleans the water up before we release it onto the city. This parking lot was started earlier in the year. As we all know, this spring and summer we've had a tremendous amount of rain. We started this parking lot, I think, in about December. It's University and Normal. This lot is also progressing nicely. We've already started paving the lot. We've got shots here that we have areas that we actually have pervious concrete in this parking lot also. You'll see the islands and places that we're going to have landscape and beautification on all of these parking lots, which I think is another benefit to student attraction on our campus.
That stone you're looking at came from the house.
The house that formerly sat on that site, it had no redeeming value as a structure or as an architectural example, but it did have some attractive stone on the exterior of the house, so we've reused it very cool in the project.
How much of that parking lot is the pervious?
I don't know, Patty, in actual square footage, but if you go back to this photo, that area there that you see this more light colored, and then where the construction trucks and traffic, that's pervious concrete.
You may not see it here, but the slope is from here to here, and that curb is going to catch it and then retain it through there.
So that's the other thing.
It's a catch.
The slope, right.
Move on to our Pierce Ford Tower parking lot that had deteriorated to a point that we had to go and we basically have regraded, resurfaced, and this parking lot is also scheduled to be done by August 23rd. All of these parking lot projects will be completed by that time and ready for students. This parking lot also, we've started already putting down some of the paving, and this picture was taken earlier in the week, and we've actually paved some more. So the rain slowed us down a little bit, but we'll back this up. We were just at the Snell Hall building. This is our Chestnut Street lot. It's got about 151 spaces. We're adding a lot of this parking lot, again, was one that was pumping and concrete, and it was unsafe. Where the paving was bucking. We've come back in, we're regrading, resurfacing, putting in landscaping for beautification. It also has a couple of areas that will have pervious concrete in it. Also, again, what we're doing is catching the water before it runs to the street so that we slow it down before it runs off down the hill. And that's something that we're all required to do today. This area here is just directly across from Snell Hall that'll have the pervious concrete. We have started construction and awarded the Chapel and Columbarium project. This is a non-denominational chapel that'll be located just down the hill and right beside the Craig Alumni Center. Ground has been broken, and this project will be completed summer of 2010. This is the site area that you see where they put the silt fencing and started construction on that project. We have just awarded the baseball clubhouse project in the area by the batting cage to the right. You see some bleachers, and then you see a tennis court area. That is the new location for the future baseball clubhouse. That project actually will be completed January 2010. This is a picture of our existing Craig Alumni Center. We had some serious issues, as you can see, with the soffit area, with some of the mortar and brick area. This is a very historic home. We've completed the work, and as you can see, it's been transformed on the outside. We've also installed all new windows in the home, so that we'll have a better energy-efficient piece of property that can continue to serve the university for years to come. This is part of our campus wayfinding and signage jogging trail project that's in progress. It's scheduled to be completed this month, in August. What it's for is for not necessarily us on campus, but for our students that are incoming, for our visitors that are incoming, for our scholars that are incoming. I think it's going to be a great enhancement to get people from one place to the other on our campus. We have an off-site WKU campus that's under construction in Owensboro, Kentucky. It's about a 26,000 square foot office and classroom facility. This is when we started earlier in the year for construction. We do have a webcam on this that takes a picture every day from the same location or vantage point, which is gives us an eye from the sky for being here in Bowling Green, so we're not running down every day to view. But as you can see, this project is on schedule, and it is proceeding very nicely in Owensboro, Kentucky. Typically, it's going to be used for they have several community college associate degree programs. This building is going to really focus on the juniors and seniors and give them a place for a baccalaureate degree. This project has just recently started. This is our Carol Nicey Center located out on Nashville Road. We tore off or demoed a section of this building in preparation for a new additional 26,000 square foot addition. This addition is going to have a conference room, an area that's going to be added, and then we have support space for that conferencing and associated areas. That space is also available where they can subdivide that up for classroom and other different types of uses for that building. Brian? I'm going to turn this over to Brian Kuster, Student Life Foundation.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. As Howard said, we are finishing our 10-year renovation projects of all of the residence halls. We have 15 halls on campus, and we have renovated all 13 of the 15. Two were built in the early 90s, and those are we've done some minor work in those. But for the most part, we spent our energy and time on the 13 that were built in the 50s and 60s. This summer, we're completing work on five total buildings. Gilbert Hall in the Valley area, along with McCormick Hall and Rhodes Harlan. In those buildings, in previous years, we have done work on the bathrooms, the common areas, and this summer we have concentrated on the bedrooms in those buildings. We also are completing our renovations of our work in Douglas Keene Hall and also in Pierce Ford Tower. At Pierce Ford, last summer we worked from the 20th floor up to the 27th floor and totally renovated that facility. And then this summer we have renovated from 19th floor down. So originally we thought the Pierce Ford work would be a three summer project, but we were able to compress that, working with our contractors to finish that building this summer.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Knowing, I mean, this almost says a moment of nostalgia, but knowing that the beds in McCormick and Gilbert were not movable beds, do all our residence halls now have movable beds?
Yes, every room has fully movable bed, bunkable beds. Students have total freedom to set their room up how they choose.
Yeah, and just a quick note on that. I worked for admissions last semester, and that is such an awesome thing when you take parents into our tour room and they see that movable bed. They're like, it can go all the way up here and all the way down. It sounds so simple, but it gives you a lot of space to use as a student. I think a lot of people always really appreciated that they could see themselves moving around and making it their room their own. So a lot of these renovations really make it a lot more homey.
It does. Just giving the students the option. You go into most rooms, and most rooms will have their beds set up just like they were when they were bolted to the floor, but giving the students that option makes the world of difference. As you can see, a lot of these renovations, we have kept the original wardrobes and have refinished them. And we do that because these are so much larger than what the wardrobes that you would buy, and it gives the students a little more space in their rooms. And again, this will complete then the major work in the residence halls. Now, we still have things we'd like to do. We want to replace windows. There's still some mechanical work. By no means have we finished everything in the residence halls that we plan to do. But we are looking towards the future. And John was talking earlier about, may you use your pointer, John?
Right there.
Was talking about the new College of Business. This is Kentucky Street. This is the parking lot where the new College of Business is scheduled to be. And then this is the,
This is an old photograph.
Yeah, this
those buildings are gone.
Yeah,
many of them are.
This is the current parking lot. Yeah. This is where the CEC building's at. The Student Life Foundation last month bought all the property that's in red here on Kentucky Street. This is 13th Street, and this is 14th Street. And our plan is to raise those buildings here in the next month, and then we're going to start building apartments to help with our graduate students, non-traditional students, some families, and then try to, if need to, continue to buy property for additional space for our traditional age students.
So is the Student Life Foundation the source of funding for raising and preparing the sites?
Yes, all the work that's done in the residence halls is paid for through the Student Life Foundation. The Student Life Foundation receives all the revenues for that's in the residence halls. And so we have spent that money then to buy this property and to raise, been at to demo the property.
And you all have done a market study to show that there's the demand for that type of housing?
Yes.
Okay.
And actually, the group came in and spent some time with faculty in the graduate college, with international students, with the TRIO programs. And again, as we look at that group of students, we want to make sure that we're building what they want. The big issue is really the price point.
Right.
We don't want necessarily to build apartments that are priced as apartments are in town. You know, if we can't build it and charge a little less,
right,
there's really no need for us to be in that market.
That's the trick, is getting your price point below.
Yes. And again, we think this is a great area. As the campus starts moving in that direction, this will be a place we think our students will definitely want to live, and with all the other changes happening in that area.
Well, you're right. That market is a void in our housing portfolio, but if for any reason you think that market isn't there, you heard Howard's report, and we sure have a market of freshmen and sophomores that are in need of housing. So,
one of the things that we would like to start also doing, and Dr. Ransom has heard this before, is we'd like to build some theme houses that would house small groups of students. That could be a language house that everyone that lives in the house, you know, would be in a certain major, and you know, they would, if they lived in a German house, then they would speak German while they're in that house, or something with, you know, a sustainability group. And so that's, we want to build smaller buildings as opposed to building another Pierce Ford Tower in the future.
Good plan.
And again, I know that was very fast, but I heard Dr. Ransdell loud and clear that time's important. Any questions I can answer for you about our university housing or anything the Student Life Foundation is doing? Yes, ma'am.
I think that building houses where all the people in the one house are of the same house with the same language thing is separating them from the campus life and from
the
other students?
I think we would... You would want to make sure that the students that are assigned there, you have a good cross-section of our students. You know, I don't think there several schools actually have created houses for minority students. And I think I'd have some concerns with that, isolating or separating students. So I think we'd want definitely, as with all of our policies, want to make sure we have a good mix of students in those facilities.
I don't think he meant students from Germany living together as much as he meant students from Edmondson County that speak German living together with students from Owensboro.
I don't see a lot of minority students that speak German.
Right.
I just don't think that's going to be a mix or whatever. I mean, whichever course it is, whichever.
Right. I think it'd be a...
It's unintentional separation. It's not like we want all you need.
We're trying to create more living, learning communities where the learning process is part of the living environment. They might be civil engineers living together. They might be students majoring in pick your discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's...
But I think that leads into some segregation of the students because... Certain students are just not in certain...
Right. I think it'd be up to make sure that we created programs that all students would have an interest in.
Yeah.
So that we don't create that kind of issue. I think that would be something we'd be concerned
about. Language immersion houses are popular, though. Those are big. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful way to learn.
Yeah, it's a good way to learn, and it's a big thing. But, you know, at the time when they were putting... all athletes in one house, you know,
right.
Like the Diddle Dorm. Oh, no, we want them to put them into the student body. They need to be a part of the student body. And then all of a sudden now we're coming around with the same thing that's going to probably segregate.
I was just going to build off Yvette's comment for just a second. And, you know, so long, I'm comfortable with so long as we're moving towards an educational goal. I have friends who have stayed at Spanish language houses at other universities, and they love it. And I guess for me it's really interesting because it'd be a very dynamic space. You know, you can stay there a summer or something like that if you come in to take a summer term class for 5 weeks, things like that. So that's pretty cool. And then I was also going to ask, you know, I know you're probably just starting to mock things up a little bit, but how many beds are you looking at for that?
We're still determining that. We're probably looking probably around 100. Of apartments, and our marketing study has recommended about 60% of those be single bedrooms and 40% be double or two bedrooms. And we're looking at traditional apartments, not the what I call the student apartments that you may see here around campus. We look at traditional apartments.
Brian, Student Life Foundation come a long way.
It sure has. And this is our 10th anniversary, as you well know.
And it's done a lot. There's just a lot of things that couldn't have happened on this campus had it not been for the Student Life Foundation. And you've been a great integral part of that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
If I could... Let me direct your attention to pages 105 and 106. And let me share with you how, when I'm going to be brief, I have taken a concept that would involve a contract that I am not getting is in two binders. Each binder is 7 or 8 inches thick in terms of detail, and I have boiled it down to 2 pages. Oh, how about that?
Excellent.
For being brief. So what I'm here to tell you is that last January, we had Johnson Controls come meet with this board and outline for you what an ESPC project is, Energy Savings Performance Contract. It's a self-funding project whereby a company is selected, they come in, they evaluate your buildings, they analyze them, and then they give you recommendations, and then you agree on a program of what would be done, and then they do the construction on third-party financing, independent of the university's debt capacity, and then the project pays for itself. In this particular case, we have completed all the steps up to the point to where we are waiting on word related to approval in Frankfurt to award the contract. And upon that approval, we will engage with Johnson Controls to proceed, which could start any time in the near future. And the project in this case is outlined for you. It is a $9 million project that would save the university $1 million in utility expenses first year. That's just huge. After completion, the first year of savings is $1 million. Should the rates go up in the future, then that amount of savings goes up with it. So that's at current today's rates. Our project is self-funded to be paid for in 15 years, and it would impact virtually all of the buildings on campus other than student life buildings. This would be academic buildings. The project manager for this project is the same project manager that's been with us who did the first ESPC project. His name is Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson's with us today, and I want to publicly acknowledge the incredible amount of work and his dedication to this project. So thank you, Ben.
Ben was also the project manager on the Snell Hall project that you were just in for lunch. So we've got a superb project management team, and Ben's the senior member of that team and does great work.
He actually is the assistant director of that department with Brian and serves us well as assistant director and managing numerous projects. So this is his project. As you can see from the outline, it would theoretically start relatively soon, and if it did, all the work would end, be completed by the end of 2010. You can read for yourself the things that it would do for the university in terms of promoting jobs, saving money, and the financing process. Over 35,000 light fixtures will be upgraded or replaced in 38 buildings. We will be installing 1,402 and more motion sensors. Now, what does that mean? Well, you've seen them. We're talking about public areas and corridors and restrooms will be put onto motion sensors so that humans don't have to turn the lights out. Even though we've been doing a good job and we've been doing well, as you heard earlier today, if you're really seriously going to get this campus down on every night and on weekends and holidays, you need systems in place that do it for you automatically. And lighting is a big part of that. And so there's going to be 1,400 motion sensors installed. I tell the story that if it's 10 o'clock at night and a professor wants to come back to his office and comes into the building, the corridors would be dark till he stepped in, not dark, but only emergency lighting on. That's the key here. It would bring him down to emergency lighting only. Step into the corridor, the lights would come on, they would follow him down the hallway to the office. He's there a few minutes, the lights would go out. When he goes back out, the lights would come back on. And then when he shuts the door, the door would lock and the lights would go out. No one has to flip a switch. We've got to get this campus basic electrical consumption at nights and weekends to its lowest denominator, and that's a small way of contributing to that and not being wasteful with our electricity. There is water savings going to be realized in this project. There are mechanical system improvements, HVAC improvements. I could go on and on. Like I said, there's probably 4,000 pages of details that's involved. But in addition to all that, on the second page, which is 106, it outlines for you the environmental impact of what we're suggesting and will accomplish with this. In that, we're going to have three renewable entities. There will be rainwater harvesting in some locations. You can see for yourself what they do. We're going to be using solar to heat the pool and the Preston Center. And as a demonstration project, we will also be doing roof-mounted turbines on a building to be finalized. But at the moment, the candidate is a PS1. Now, they're not going to produce an enormous amount of electricity, but they will be a very good demonstration project for us as part of the project. The carbon reduction and carbon emission reductions are outlined for you at the bottom of that page in terms of the environmental impacts. This is a tremendous commitment on this university's part related to proper management of its resources and its utilities. Coupled with everything else we're doing, it sends a tremendous message about our commitment to sustainability. We would not be doing another project in the next 15 years. So what I'm saying to you is, I don't see us doing, never say never, but given the scope of this, I don't see us doing another one of these ESPC projects in the next 15 years. But when we do, complete the next 15 years, all of the savings will come to us. All of them. The life cycle expectation of most everything in this project is well beyond 15 years. Light fixtures, etc., will have much lighter, greater life cycle than 15 years. So this is an exciting project. Now, let me just couple that by saying there are two more things that we're going to be doing. Dr. Ransdell talked earlier about how we had some utility dollar savings as a result of some energy management initiatives the past year. We're going to be taking that savings and we're going to be investing it in our steam plant to give us added capacity for having steam-generated heat from gas, natural gas. You may ask yourself, why do you want to do that? Well, it's an involved story, but make it simple. With this increased capacity, we can choose whichever fuel source is the most affordable and economical for us. We will be able to reduce significantly our use of coal, and we will reduce our coal usage, and we will only need coal at times when we're at peak demand for heat. It will also give us the capacity to use the fuel which is most affordable. But it expands the capability. It'll be a tremendous investment, and it will give us long-term benefits and a cost avoidance of use of coal at a significant levels in the future. So that is a significant project. And last but not least is our facilities management, along with these initiatives, will be going in every building on campus and weatherizing it as part of this project. Each building will be weatherized. We'll be doing a lot of caulking and sealing and weather stripping to improve the exterior envelopes of the buildings as a university initiative that will be coupled with these other projects. So the sum total will be well over $10 million in expenditures that will be making an investment for us for the future to save energy and reduce our carbon footprint. Yeah, I'm excited about it. I think it's fantastic. Any questions?
Think we'll ever be able to get off coal? I'm sorry. Do you think we'll ever be able to get off coal?
Yeah, I do.
Good.
It's not necessarily an intentional goal, but we will be in a position where we will be close to that with this reinvestment. It won't be that we can intentionally do it, but we will have the capacity of reducing our coal. If we use coal at the present levels we've been using it, we're going to need to make even more investments
in the steam plant that would allow us to meet EPA guidelines to do so. So by making this investment, we can get ourselves to where we will be using coal, but it'd be at a threshold below the EPA requirements for additional scrubbers and expenses to use it.
Right.
So that's why it would give us flexibility and options.
I just had a quick question. Where was this, just about the project itself, where did that initial $9.8 million come from? Is that from your all's budget over in campus services?
No, sir. That is external funding. Okay. Here's the best part of the story. Johnson Controls brings the financing for the $9.9 million. And they guarantee the savings. And so the energy we save pays for the financing that they bring to the table. So it's self-funding. It pays for itself. And by the way, we only selected direct energy saving opportunities to go into the project. Every nickel, every dime saved will be verifiable and measurable through a measurement and verification metering process. So we will be able to verify. And then at the end of the day, the beauty of this is if they don't achieve the savings, they guarantee it, they pay the difference. Johnson Controls.
What kind of term on the finance, John? What kind of term on the financing?
You know, that's something that we're still waiting on. At the moment, of course, it's a 15-year, huh?
I'm sure there'll be interest charged on it.
Oh, yeah. And this savings generates enough to pay for the cost of money.
Well, the contract's a 15-year contract, isn't it?
15-year term, then?
15-year term.
15-year contract. When Johnson Controls has their money back, they go away, and then we keep all the savings completely from that point forward.
I want to compliment Pete Mahurin, who's been advising us on this.
Pete's a good one.
And he's been very helpful with Johnson Controls and us in the way this will be done through a leasing. I don't know if that sounds like the wrong term, but it's a leasing arrangement.
I understand that.
Okay.
It's like a copy machine or something like that.
Or leasing the equipment, so to speak.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Very good. Brian, thanks. Ben? Tom?
Thank you. I've got one action item and a presentation that Dr. Ranzo and I talked about sort of on the midway point in the campaign. So the action item we can do pretty quickly. It's fairly perfunctory. The Council for Post-Secondary Education requires that the board approve the matching money that has gone forward with donor gifts, and then we submit them to CPE, and then they return the matching money up front. But along with the board approving it, they also want a resolution indicating that all of our match will what percentage of our match will be endowment and what percentage will be capital. In our case, we've made the decision to make it 100% endowment. So they require, in order for us to get the matching money, which is $2.4 million, and we'd like to get that to work as quickly as possible, we need you all to approve that upon Dr. Ransdell's recommendation, all of our $2,439,000 to be specific, will be used for endowment and not capital. So if there's any questions on that, I'd be glad to answer them, but otherwise I'm looking for a motion to approve this and report it to CPE.
You got a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much. With that, I've got two-part presentation. One is where we are with the campaign currently, some numbers, and also something we don't always do, which is to talk about the significance of a couple of gifts. And then I want to show you at the midway point, in a very difficult economic climate, how do we get to the finish line of $200 million? And I'll do that very first of all, let me share with you our numbers. For the first slide is our campaign totals. You may have read in the Daily News recently about our $144 million that we announced as of June 30th. We're very proud of that fact. And as you may recall, in September 07, we kicked off the campaign with 91 in hand. And so considering what's happened since 07 with the economy, the stock market, et cetera, we're very proud of the fact that we've been able to stay, in fact, ahead of track. You can see we need to get to 156 to stay on track next year, and we're tracking ahead of that right now. Now, that doesn't mean that we didn't have some challenges last year with our fundraising. I'll explain that in a minute. Next, our endowment. Briefly, again, I'm proud of the fact that in a very, very challenging environment, our endowment was down less than any others in the state of Kentucky. The average decrease in the endowments in the state of Kentucky was about 26-28%. We are down about 18%. And the reason for that is I think we have a prudent investment policy. We also kept some money on the sidelines about 18 months ago, and that proved to be very helpful, needless to say, on the return. And the net result of that is I'm working with our investment subcommittee of the foundation board, as well as our third-party advisor from Milwaukee, with our managers, and we are starting to be much more aggressive. We started with sort of a toe in the water back in February, putting money back in, dollar cost averaging back into the market. Now we're going to ratchet that up a little. We've got about $6 million worth of cash to invest, which puts us in a positive situation, we think, and a chance to really return some investment over the next couple of years. Our goal on our overall investments is to at least hit 8% return on an average. And that's based on a 4.5 payout, some money for expenses, and then about a 3% inflation rate. So with all that in mind, in order to get 8%, you can't stay in fixed income. So we have had to go out and do some challenges and work on our asset allocation. But long story short, we're very proud of the fact that we are ahead of the curve right now and moving back into the positive range from where we were underwater about a year ago.
To what do you attribute the growth in the Ogden Foundation?
Ogden Foundation,
4.6 to 6.3, how'd that happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. They had some trust. It wasn't because of investments. They had some charitable remainder trust that came into play, third-party trusts that are now part of the Ogden Trust.
So it was money added to it. From
private gifts or charitable remainder trusts and the like. There may have been some investment growth, but most of that was through gifts. They are pretty much primarily in fixed income, if I understand it. We do not manage either Ogden. And of course, I work very closely with Alex Downing, who runs the College Heights Foundation. Next. This is the bad news. We had a significant drop in our cash donations last year. There's several reasons for that. Number one being the economy. Number two, the beginning of last 07 and 08, we had some very large gifts at the beginning of the fiscal year. So we were trying to catch up throughout the year. And then on top of that, as I say, donors are pausing right now, even though I think the good news is they're not saying no. They are saying give me some more time or helping to structure some things. So we're having to be much more creative with donors. End waiting gifts. I just gave Dr. Ransdell a gift agreement that's an end weighted gift. By that I mean they in the 5-year pledge period they give less in the first couple of years and more in the out years. So there's a lot of things along the plan giving side that I'll talk about in a little bit. Next. Our president's circle was basically flat. We were down a little bit. This did not go all the way back to 98, but if it did, it would show you that when Dr. Ransdell took office, we had about 400 president's circle members giving 1,000 or more, so you can see this very significant growth. This is really the backbone of our cash donations to the university. Briefly, I want to give you a capital project update. John already alluded to some of them. Stadium, let me allude to this. Questions about that. The stadium is paid off, in case there's any questions on that. The HAF helped us bridge the gap, and we did pay off the stadium last year. The $2.2 million is still related to major naming opportunities that are still out there, particularly the $1 million stadium club, which we are still seeking a major corporate or individual donor for. Next, the baseball clubhouse. Already John showed that as well. We're basically trying to raise money now for furnishings for the clubhouse. We've got the structure and the shell of the clubhouse done for private support, but we still have a little bit of ways to go. The chapel is basically funded. Dr. Ransdell and I have a couple of trips scheduled coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks to try and finalize. We do have a couple of other pledges that we have not gotten written commitments on yet. So we're very, very close to finishing everything up. I don't know if you want to say anything.
Well, it's a $1.7 million project, so the project is financed, but we'd really like to raise endowment money for that. Actually, I'd like to raise another $200,000 or $300,000 for that to secure a handsome endowment. Those numbers do not include money that people have paid for columbarium niches, so that is
right.
Put into a separate fund that will be a perpetual fund to maintain those elements.
Right.
But it's $1.7 million now. It was $1.6 million when we approved it.
The state authorization was $1.7 million.
Okay.
So that was the maximum that were authorized for the project. But that project was put out to bid. All the bids came in over, had to be rebid, and we had to fight like the dickens to keep that under the 1.7. I'll tell you the biggest problem we're facing right now with all of our capital projects, and it hit the baseball clubhouse and the chapel, both of which went out to bid, both of which came in way over bid, and we could not figure out why until we began the analysis. Prevailing wages went up unbelievably in January. Some of the hourly rates went from $9-$10 an hour to $35 and $40 an hour. Incredible hikes in prevailing wage rates in January of 2009 at a time when nobody in our society was getting that kind of a raise. And it's caused any project that we bid over the last 6 months came in 10 to 20% over. And it took us a while to figure out why. And we finally zeroed in, and it was because of a raise in contractor prevailing rate wages went up in this economic environment, sometimes 4- and 5-fold. Killed us.
I just want to make sure that I understand this. So it's now $1.7 million, which you have.
Right.
And you've got an extra $100,000, you're trying to raise another $100,000. To create this endowment for care management, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's...
Yeah. And I will say, not all that is in hand. We're getting some in pledges, but we will have the balance ready to go for the construction piece.
Okay, now back to the $2 million for the football stadium. Just help,
yeah.
help me out with that again.
The stadium's paid off.
Because the HAF helped.
Right. They helped us bridge the gap on that. It's all private support. And what we're trying to do is raise some additional money for enhancements, for endowment, football operations, all the above.
HAF had reserve funds, which they approved some of those reserve funds, paid it off. Bills were paid by June 30, and now HAF hopes to rebuild the reserves. And some of that may go to help HAF fulfill its reserves, but it may be used for lots of other things too.
Clinical Education Complex, a very, very important academic facility that was built all with private support about 2 years ago, is completed except for about $75,000 that we're still having to bring in. We've got donor pledges. We're using that to pay off the balance of the construction loan, so I'm very proud of that as well. Alumni facility, and I will say, as I say that, capital projects nationwide are the hardest dollars to raise. I mean, all my colleagues say the same thing. Endowments, scholarships, professorships, people are still interested. Capital projects are tough. So this just gives you a quick snapshot. Alumni facility, we've raised about $2 million. We still want to raise about $1 million, and that is a target that will change depending on when we finally get final architectural plans. And then finally, the student publications building, really a wonderful project that was done with a grassroots effort, was paid off with a few large gifts, but mostly $500, $1,000 working journalist gifts that make it a very special project. It was a tough project to raise money for, but over time people were very generous, and that is done. So I just wanted to give you a quick snapshot on capital. While primarily the campaign out of the $200 million, you can see only a small portion of his capital. The biggest portion that people give for is scholarships and professorships. And I want to highlight some scholarships. Numbers are great. Everybody's for more money. But I want to demonstrate a little bit about the significance of some of these gifts. Quickly, you can see that we had 267 new scholarships of at least $10,000 or more since Dr. Ransdell took office. Next is one scholarship I want to highlight. Sam Dunaway is a gentleman from Fordsville, Kentucky, in Ohio County. If you haven't been to Ohio County or Fordsville, you don't have to ask which diner you're going to meet him at. I met him there at 5:30 in the morning about 3 years ago. Donor of ours introduced me to him. He's not a WKU graduate. In fact, he's not a college graduate at all. And he was interested in possibly doing some scholarships at Talk with the University of Kentucky. Well, over time, we built a relationship with him. He trusted us. He invested initially $100,000 in a scholarship. And in a very short period of time, he has rapidly grown that scholarship fund and just pledged an additional $1 million to that scholarship fund. Now, that's a big number, and obviously I'm very pleased from a campaign standpoint. But let me show you the net result. These full tuition scholarships, go to the next slide, Jeff. This is Mr. Dunaway. These are five of his students. We provide eight fully endowed scholarships. This young man on the left is a civil engineering graduate. This young man here is a physics graduate who's got a very prestigious
internship. Student, not graduate yet.
Student, I'm sorry. This student is a clinical dietitian major, and these two are pre-med. And they're all from Ohio County or surrounding counties, and they are, let's say, they're first-generation college students, except for the girl in the middle whose mom teaches in Butler County. And a lot of these kids may not have had a chance to go to college without the scholarship, but all of them, even if they could piece it together, would have had to work a couple jobs to try and make ends meet. And all of them tell me the same thing. Because of Mr. Dunaway's generosity, they've been able to focus in. And if you think about, extrapolate 20 years down the line and think about the impact that each of these individuals in engineering, medicine, and otherwise will have, it's a really tremendous impact. And then if you think about it a little bit further and think about the fact that 100 years from now, the Dunaway Endowment will still be there impacting students. You know, we talk about legacy. We all hope that something we do has an impact. And these buildings are wonderful. All of our friends are wonderful. But endowments, as Dr. Ransdell says, last forever. 200, 300 years from now, these endowments will still be allowing students to access higher education. These professorships will still be there impacting WKU in a very positive way. So that's why I want to take a minute and just say, with all the numbers, I want to point to the fact that these do have a hell of an impact on the university and what we're trying to achieve. And so we get real caught up in the numbers, but this is the power of giving. Next, I want to just highlight briefly five significant scholarships. When I say briefly, I'll just list them. Go ahead and bring them down. These are all $1 million scholarships. The last one I just threw in there for fun because Pontiac, I'm not sure, Jim, that still exists at the brand.
Unfortunately, it's gone.
That's what I thought. So we do have the check from Pontiac.
You got that one.
They're all significant scholarships that have been funded within Dr. Ransdell, within the last few years. And that are having tremendous impact for students. And I know Dean agrees with that sentiment. So that's a scholarship highlight. Another time I'll come back and talk about professorships. Let me run through recent major gifts, bring them on down. I'll be glad to answer any questions. I will highlight this. This one is a professorship, and it's just something we've announced with a match that'll bring $1 million professorship to engineering, and it will be there. Fifth full professorship, Barbara, in the engineering school. Next. Okay, second part, and again, I will be brief. I know you've been listening to a lot of presentations. How do we reach the $200 million goal? First of all, on our scale of gifts, we've got to continue to work on that top end of the scale of gifts, that $20 million lead gift we still have not had, although we do have a $17 million lead gift at this point. And throughout that pyramid, we are still identifying different individual, what we call prospects, in each of those categories. And that's how we focus in through our research office, through volunteers who give us names, through continued relationships, discussions. It's amazing how people self-identify through that process. And that's really the blocking and tackling part of our job. I was in Chicago 2 weeks ago, found out from a couple of discovery visits about some very significant potential individuals who could help us with the campaign. Next, this also shows you the growth of gifts to WKU over time, and the fact that last year we processed about 27,000 gifts to WKU, and that's grown significantly since Dr. Ramsdell's tenure. And this is another way that we're trying to get to the finish line, our planned giving program. We've had $53 million in new deferred gifts since the beginning of this campaign. We've had about not 86 million now that are documented. When Dr. Ramsdell took office, we had about 7 million in documented testamentaries. This could be charitable remainder trust, charitable deed trust, bequests, gifted annuities, all the above. So that's been a significant part of our work. We have 25 documented gifts in this category of a million or more. And then lastly, before I get off plan giving, although I will show you the events real quickly, I will say we're just hiring a new plan giving assistant director, and that's really going to bolster our efforts in the whole plan giving field. And I don't want you to think that all of our work relates to just asking, because we're out talking with donors. A lot of our work relates to alumni events, and I just wanted to list for you the fact that really thousands of people and hundreds of events that we have every year in alumni events. And here's a couple of pictures of from those events. If you go to the next slide, Jeff, this is of course our Hall of Distinguished Alumni, where we get about 500 people every year at homecoming. Of course, there's our last year's recipients with Dr. Ramsdell. And there were a couple of others I guess I took out from the end. But all this is to say a lot of information in a short period of time. We do need your help. We appreciate the Board of Regents very much. Their support of the campaign is necessary, both personally, and also many of you have let me know about individuals who could help the university, corporations, foundations. So I'm here today just to give you an update to tell you it's going very well, but we've still got a lot of work over the next 2.5-3 years of this campaign left. So thank you very much for your attention. I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Good. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Anything for Tom? It's all on the way to $200 million goal. Robin, okay. Public Affairs.
One of the things I thought I would update you on just very, very quickly is where we are in the federal appropriations process. We're beginning to get word of the initial actions in the House and Senate on appropriations, and we have actually done quite well, probably a little better than maybe we expected. To this point, between, frankly, Senator Mitch McConnell and Congressman Brett Guthrie, we have about $10.8 million in earmarked projects. Again, this is the very beginning of that process, and it's very possible that, you know, through the end of the process, we may lose some of those, but I'm fairly confident that we're well on our way to a very successful year. A couple of those projects, the ARS, the Agriculture Research Service, laboratory construction funds, that's $2 million additional this year, plus the 3.1 that we get annually in operating. So that's the biggest part of this our progress this year. We have $2 million for science equipment. Those are going to be, that's for state-of-the-art equipment. Dr. Ramsdell, you asked earlier, I don't think furnishings would really that they could acquire it, but it will be state-of-the-art equipment for the science campus. The robotics lab that Dr. Farrell talked about this morning, that is that's funded through federal earmark. A good bit of the equipment in the two labs in the old, in the other building, the science and engineering building, those are also funded with this same money. Not this $2 million, but this was total a $6 million project. We also have, at least right now, we have money for, we have $1.1 million for Bowling Green Data Center at the Center for Research and Development. This is a new project, very, very significant project for us to begin funding. It's a total $5 million project, so it would be a multiple-year request on our part. And then we have received transportation funds for replacing shuttle buses. I say receive, that's not the right word. It's in the initial budget. We have $1,075,000 right now in the Senate budget. That was announced yesterday. and then 250 in the House budget. So again, those are probably going to come together. We may not get both of those at the end. And then a significant project that Congressman Guthrie has been able to secure in the House budget so far is a $500,000 project for Owensboro to put equipment in the new Owensboro building, and a biofuels research project is $500,000 that'll be that includes using bio oil, biomass, more than I can explain since Dr. Farrell's not here. I won't even try. But a couple of significant projects that, in fact, everything we asked Congressman Guthrie to do, he was able to deliver something on. So anyway, we're well on our way to a good year on federal earmarks, which is probably not what we would have expected in this environment, but they've done well. Very quickly, I'll give you just a year-end snapshot. A lot of times we provide you with a listing of media stories. You all should get the clips every day, the news clips, so we're not going to give you that listing. I'm going to probably go to only twice a year giving you a media report. But the last time I talked about this, I told you that we had created a news blog, that we created Facebook, a Facebook account for WKU, that we were using Twitter and kind of began giving you some of the stats on that. The purpose is to really push our information out there, get people to subscribe, get people to come to us to get news. That really is where that's heading. And views on our news blog went in July of last year from 245, which is when we started that news blog, and they're up this year in June over 4,200. And that's on it. Those are daily views, or I'm sorry, monthly views. The top stories of the year, unfortunately, the top story of the year, the thing that got the most views, the thing that got the most attention, were the events in October of the student altercation. In one day, we had 17,000 views to our webpage that in 1 month. That's okay. The blog, the news blog, in 1 month. On one day. I do get that right. I can't see Bob well enough from over there. So one day, over 17,000, and it was the day after that occurred. So that was not the kind of news that we want, the top four views that we had on our news blog throughout the year all related to those events. Other things, the Emmys, the Emmys has been a big one. The death of Laura Cheney, a freshman student, that was one of our top stories. Upcoming events, that's a nice thing to know. People are going to our website looking to see what's happening on campus, and that really is, that's about our top fifth view on the news blog. And department head completes Trans-Siberian expedition to Russia. That was one of our bigger blog views. We have, this year, Bob Skipper and his staff, which consists of Tommy Newton, and also Amy DeCesare, is on Bob's staff, and Clinton Lewis, who takes photographs, and then our webmaster also is on Bob's staff at the moment. That will move to marketing eventually. But it's a small staff. They supplement it with some student workers as well. And last year sent out 434 news releases. The top coverage that we have for the year, again, the October events, but the NASCAR race, that was a big story, got a lot of news coverage on that. The hard shutdown for the energy savings, a lot of coverage on that. Kenny Perry at the Ryder Cup, and the Kentucky Teacher Hall of Fame, which is something that we do. It's an event we do in Frankfort every year to recognize teachers from across Kentucky and the Kentucky, the Louis B. Nunn Kentucky Teacher Hall of Fame. The Facebook page, we started Facebook this year, and we now have 4,900 followers, fans, on the WKU Facebook page, which is pretty significant growth in a real short period of time, and 200 followers on Twitter. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's pretty significant, given that we just sort of entered all that fray. And actually, it wasn't until late last fall that we even really knew what Twitter was. So anyway, I want to compliment Bob and his staff on their efforts. And then one of the groups that you all see that's a part of the Public Affairs Division, you see them all the time, but we never really talk about them very much, and so we're going to do that a little bit today, is the event staff. You see Lucinda Anderson at everything. You talk to Lucinda a lot. You You know, she's the one that takes care of all the nice things that we get to do, all of the, you know, the food and the invitations. I mean, she really, really does a lot of work, everything at Dr. Ransdell's home. And Lucinda's the director of ceremonies and special events, so she's part of the event staff. Jeff Younglove is the director of campus and community events, and Jeff is probably the most behind-the-scenes person of anybody. He is responsible for tables and chairs, responsible for sound projectors, you know, all those things. A couple things didn't work today, but we got it all worked out. But Jeff has a small staff as well. Rachel Manning Goodman. Rachel is with him today. You see Rachel around a good bit. They're the ones that are always running around, putting up, you know, putting up the flags, getting everything together, all the logistics of every event that, pretty much every event that occurs on this campus, they take care of. And Jeff's going to tell you a little bit about that today. The other person on his staff, Rachel's the assistant director, Sarah Thomas, who you probably don't see a lot. Sarah's an events assistant. And then there are three services staff, and those three individuals, they take care of every chair and every table that goes up and down on this campus. They used to be part of the facility staff, been moved to the event staff a few years ago because they primarily did work for Jeff and handling events. And those individuals, they are some of the hardest working people on this campus. Every athletic event, they are there. Every, you know, so they also work their regular job during the day, and then they're, you know, they're working every single event we have at night. They're doing it. And that, again, James McCoy, Larry Goodman, and DeWalker Don Dupani are the three individuals, and I did want to recognize them by name. You probably won't ever see them, but they're responsible for everything that happens here. So I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. Jeff's area generates revenue. He generates revenue not for events, staff purposes so much, but for other groups across campus, certainly athletics, auxiliaries, housing, dining, all of that, all those areas benefit from the work that Jeff and his staff do on events where we generate people coming to campus. And certainly, Dean, there's absolutely no question that many of the events that are, particularly some of the larger events, a lot of the camps that occur over the summer, those bring prospective students to campus and have a lot to do with admissions and those numbers as well. So I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. And if you don't know Jeff, he's lightning quick. Half the time you don't see him when he walks in and out of the room. And I can guarantee you he'll be brief.
3 minutes is what I was told. It might be 3.5. I hate to take responsibility for the technical part of it today. Dr. Favoda is probably ready to shoot me. That's the first time this projector hasn't worked. But that's why Rachel Manning Goodman is here. So if there's any problems technically today, now it's her fault for at least this one. You heard yesterday a little bit about marketing. Actually, we could probably call this a marketing report too, because what we really believe that we do a lot of in events is marketing, bringing students to campus and touching every department and area on campus. Just a quick picture, basically the last year and a half, the year 2008, these are internal events, which basically are events that we support from groups on campus that are doing this. Sometimes it's indirect support. Sometimes it's direct support. They call us and say, listen, I've got a conference coming. Where do I begin? And we will help them with planning from facilities to we'll put them in touch with food services. And then summer, which I'll talk about in just a second, we handle housing aspects of it as well. But for the year of 2008, and that's the calendar year, and these numbers are not precise. This is kind of what we came up with. But, 67,000 people basically on campus through events that we coordinated or were a part of. That's 369 events. And in 2009, first half of this year, so actually we're ahead of pace from last year, 225 events and then 35, almost 36,000 people. These are just some of the examples that we participate in. Some of them, again, we have direct responsibility for, but most of them are in a support mode in planning and that type of thing. Next one. These are what we call external and community events. We kind of differentiate between two types of things. During the school year, for the most part, in the fall semester and spring semester, most of our time is spent on internal events, whether it be dedications, whether it be luncheons, anything like that. And then in the summertime is really when we hit hard the external events, which are revenue-producing events. All of these in black are basically non-revenue events. Our revenue events help pay for some of those non-revenue events. but again, we're a little bit ahead of schedule. We had 61,000 visitors last year that participated in things like the 10K, concerts in Diddle Arena. Any non-university athletic event in Diddle Arena, our office coordinates, handles the booking of Diddle Arena, promoting Diddle Arena, the Stadium Club, we talked about that. We've already had several weddings, receptions in there, and events in there. It's become a very popular place. And those are things that generate revenue for us to help us pay for things like Chamber of Commerce and Girls Sweet 16 that don't, they generate some revenue, but most of that revenue is put right back in to pay for expenses of those types of things. But the 10K is a big one. It's 28 years now that it has been on our campus as part of it. And then, you know, from wedding reception to just general room rental. Rachel is our wedding reception expert now. She handles all mothers of brides who can be a handful at times. The Kentucky building, the renovations we've done there, has become a very popular place for wedding receptions, and as I said, the Stadium Club, from outdoor to indoor. Next. And we do have some events that do produce revenues, and fortunately, these produce revenues for the food area, and these are events strictly through our office that we handle a lot of the billing on, invoicing on, food services charges us, and then we turn around and called centralized billing, really. A group that comes to campus loves to get one bill rather than a bill from housing or a bill from food services. It was that way at one time. We went probably about 8 or 9 years ago to centralized billing, and which just streamlines everything. Most of this revenue we do during about 2 months of the year, during the summer. That is our big revenue time, camps. And by no means is it all the camps that are on campus. Again, these are ones that go through our offices. Food revenues, and let me say, we couldn't do this without the excellent and outstanding food reputation we have for our facilities and housing, too. And there's one event that I'll talk about in just a second that we will be doing next year only because of the housing facilities that we have. And we just get rave reviews. We do surveys from these groups after they leave about our food and our housing. Second to none, at least for most of these groups that do come. This athletic revenue, that is from the events that are in Diddle Arena, concerts that are revenue-producing events. We do rent the arena out at times, and whenever we generate revenue, it goes back actually in the fund to help pay for debt service on Diddle Arena. So those are net revenues after expenses for that area. The other revenues and internal costs are kind of the cost of running some of those events. And what we use, the revenues that come into our office, to buy more tables, to buy more chairs, to buy more staging, to buy technical equipment, and that type of thing. We do not have a budget, per se, from the university to replenish those things, so we do that through the revenues we generate. And because we do not charge any internal groups use for any tables, chairs, anything like that. So we use the revenues we generate from paying groups to help with the internal groups that there is no charging for. Rachel? And just a few, three new upcoming events. One, we will be hosting December 5th and 6th, and with the cooperation of the Bowling Green Convention Center, Convention Bureau, CDB, we will have the state high school championships. They've been in Papa John's Stadium for the last 3 or 4 years at least. KHSAA, we have been hosting the Girls Sweet 16, pretty much the permanent home for it now with the support of Houchins Industries. And this year, we'll spend some time in Smith Stadium because December 4th is our final home game. That's a Thursday night. December 5th and 6th, we'll have three high school games each day. Starting at 11 o'clock that morning, we'll play three on a Friday, and we will play three on a Saturday. So we are now, for the next 2 years at least, the home of the Kentucky High School Football Championship. And again, expect to bring 35,000 to 40,000 people on our campus for that. You heard yesterday in the marketing about the importance of getting people on this campus. We believe strongly in that, to get people on this campus. It sells itself. Next one. This is a conference, and this is our first stab. I always like to try to, every 1 or 2 years, do something we haven't done before. And this is one we haven't done before. Without the support of the academic area, we wouldn't be able to do it this time, as well as housing and food services. But next May, for about, they will start registering actually on a Saturday, and they will leave on a Thursday. We expect anywhere from 2,500 to 3,000 middle school, high school age students, accelerated Christian education. Most of these are homeschool and private school individuals. And this actually grew out of a regional conference we've been doing for ACE, is what we call it, For the last 5 years, they've been in Downing University Center, and they have been here during spring break week. They set their spring break for those private schools with our spring break just so they can come here. We had such a good relationship with them. They went to their international people and said, listen, we think WKU would be a great place to have the international one. They first contacted us, and we are going to be using all of Ivan Wilson Center, Fine Arts Center, probably a large portion of Grice Hall, Garrett, Van Meter, Diddle Arena, Preston Center, all of the athletic facilities. It's a huge event for us. They rotate it around each year, and this will be our first go at it. But because of the relationship and because of the positive visit that they had during the regional conference, they went to their headquarters and said, we think you ought to look at WKU for an international conference. We signed a contract for it. The big thing about this, from a revenue standpoint, gross revenues, which will go to housing, academic areas, food services, because these will be staying on campus, which, again, we wouldn't be able to do had these residence halls not been renovated. But in the neighborhood of, we're estimating about $350,000 to $400,000 in revenue for a five-day event. So pretty big for us, and obviously we're going to try to put our best foot forward. And then returning for its fourth visit, I think, we will once again have Elephants in Diddle Arena on May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. When we renovated the arena, one of the things we said we wanted to do was have something that had not had the capability of doing that before. The circus was not on our mind at that point in time, but we will have Elephants, and this is from one of the last shows. It has been successful for us. They like, again, coming back. And we like having them back. And there are some. It's an event that I had never done before when we did the circus. And it is different. And hopefully, if you look at those dates, that's 1 week before commencement. So we'll hopefully have everything cleaned up by the time before commencement. They didn't have any. We actually, not the last time, but two times ago, the horse stables were at the end zone of in Diddle Arena. They were not here last time, so we didn't have quite the cleanup issue as what we had before. Rachel. And Robin said that, you know, tables and chairs, this just kind of gives you, again, not precise numbers, but in the first 6 months of this year, basically our three guys serving the entire campus, plus the tables you sat at and chairs you sat at today during lunch and were set up yesterday by them, but basically about 11,000 chairs and 1,300 tables so far. Set up, taken down, delivered, etc. this year. So they do a lot of work and could not do it without them, no doubt. And we all have the same attitude. You know, there is no we can't do it. You know, it's opportunities. And then finally, we talked, you heard about taglines and marketing. Well, our tagline has been, and I think Rachel actually came up with it, is we make it happen. And that's what we try to do each and every day. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
That's it. That's all I have.
Good. Thank you. Very good. Wood?
Thanks, Robin.
No pressure here. All right. I'm not going to do any slides or anything. If you'll turn to page 136, please. Just want to give you the update on the 1A transition. In November of 2006,
y'all recall that Forrest asked for this report at this meeting.
This is a follow up to that request. In November of 2006, the WKU Board of Regents voted to elevate WKU football from 1AA to 1A. Part of the transition that the NCAA requires to move to 1A is a 2-year. Kind of a probationary period where you transition from 1AA to 1A. We recently received a letter from the NCAA that approved our official transition as being complete, and we will be welcomed at the end of August as the newest 1A member in NCAA athletics. So we'll be the 120th member of 1A intercollegiate athletics. Looking over the last 2 years upon our transition and the type of success that we enjoyed, one relative to the media, in your packet there's an article that's been reprinted from USA Today. That was a cover story this past October on the front page of USA Today Sports. If we were to buy the amount of space that article gave WKU, it would cost us $1 million. and that was a very favorable article as well. So that was one of the returns that we've received on the transition from 1AA to 1A. When you look about TV exposure, at 1AA level, you get very little TV coverage. At the 1A level, starting this year and even in our transition year, just about half of our games have been telecast and broadcast. This year in 09, we have 12 games. Six of those 12 games will be broadcast. The first game that we play this year will be against Tennessee down in Knoxville on September 5th. We've just received the TV information for that game. WBKO will be telecasting that game locally live at 11:21 a.m., 12:21 p.m. Eastern Time in Knoxville. So we'll start at 11:21 here in Bowling Green. That game will go to 73 TV markets. Those TV markets represent more than 54 million households, or 47% of the U.S. So our first game as a 1A counter in the fall of 09 will reach 54 million households, 47% of the U.S. So, again, instant payoff from our 1A transition. I told you that six of our games are going to be on TV. Four away games are on TV. Two home games are on TV. If you have a season ticket package for WKU football, you can come watch six games live and in person. You can follow four games on TV. So you're going to be able to follow 10 of the 12 football games either live or on TV. That never happened at the 1AA level. You are hard-pressed to follow any of our away contests. The scheduling benefits. Obviously, we announced in the last couple days a four-year contract with the University of Kentucky. We will be playing Kentucky twice in Lexington and then twice down in Nashville at the Titan Stadium. That will count as WKU's home game. It'll count as our home attendance. We also worked 4,000 student tickets into the game down in Nashville each year. So every year, 4,000 students will be admitted free with their valid WKU ID, just as they are here in Bowling Green, to the games held in Nashville. So we'll have 4,000 lower-level seats for our students down there. But we've also had contracts home and home with South Florida. We have a four-year deal with Navy. They'll come here twice. We go to Annapolis twice. A four-year deal with Army. We go there twice. They come here twice. So those are the types of opportunities that we're getting from a scheduling standpoint that, again, you just would not see at the 1AA level. When you look at the licensing royalties, in 06, $102,000 was coming in from our licensed merchandise program, everything from hats, T-shirts, sweatshirts, apparel. And then you can see how the licensing has grown now to $155,000 annually. To put that, just so you understand how that works, the university receives anywhere from 8 to 10% of the wholesale cost of goods. So when you take that and then multiply it to the retail value, and we're receiving $105,000 in royalties, again, on the wholesale cost, imagine what our university bookstore is doing with this growth in licensed apparel, because most of our sales go through the WKU bookstore. So this has been a huge asset, this move to our WKU bookstore. The HAF, Hilltopper Athletic Foundation, since we announced our move, we are now at 1,600 members who contribute annually to WKU Athletics. That's the highest membership we've ever enjoyed within HAF. The growth in revenue for HAF has gone from $1.2 million annually to $2.3 million annually. So it's increased over $1 million a year, up 77% since 2006. With regard to ticket sales and student attendance, that's on page 137. The last year of 1AA, our season tickets were 1,851. Last year, they were 8,648. So we've really increased our season ticket sales. It looks like we went down from 07 to 08 in season ticket sales. We did, but we had two companies who had purchased 500 season tickets each, 1,000 total season tickets. The first year we made our announcement, they said they were going to do that one time, and then they were going to back off and let other people come in and buy them. So we lost 1,000 tickets between 07 and 08, but obviously we replaced a good percent of those with twos and fours from families and individuals buying season tickets. The number that I'm the most thrilled about is our student attendance. You look at what it was our last year at 1AA football, 7,400, and then in 08, 21,440. So student attendance per game has increased 247%. I think our student body really has resonated with the 1A move. We've also moved our student body behind the visiting team bench. Mm-hmm. So they go from goal line to goal line directly behind the visiting team bench. So I think they're a little bit more involved as a 12th man in the game. The total average attendance, you can see, has risen from 9,000 in 06 to 15,089 in 07 to 15,603 in 08. That's total paid attendance. That's the report that we submit to the NCAA. So our attendance keeps growing each year. Revenues have gone from 200,000 in 06 to over 500,000 in 08. So again, revenue is keeping pace. Season tickets increased by 367%. Student attendance by 247%, ticket revenue 153%, total attendance increase 72%. So you can see that we're enjoying great success in virtually every measurable dimension as a result of our transition from 1AA to 1A. I'll take any questions you might have.
Quick question. Thank you for this. This is very interesting. What I'd like to see, and I don't think it would be appropriate until the first quarterly meeting of 10, and maybe the second quarterly meeting, you tell me, but I'd like to see some kind of a bottom line analysis. I mean, given the expense to construct the stadium, and maybe second quarter, you tell me. Could you have that data by our first quarterly meeting in January, or would you need second quarter to really net it all out and see where we are? But I just kind of like to see where we're progressing on our bottom line toward making, you know, toward making this profitable and, you know, covering the expense of building the stadium.
Well, I don't think Wood can factor in the cost of the stadium because that's not in his budget.
Yeah.
And that was an expense, probably not $49 million worth, that was scheduled before we made the move in football. Probably accelerated the scope of the project, but that was on our books long before we decided to make a transition in football. That was a 40-year-old facility that has 10 million of that as academic space for PE kinesiology and sport is the name of the new department, I believe, Barbara, in that facility. So I don't know if you can.
I would think you have to leave that variable out.
An orange there when you start talking about the stadium debt service as part of the athletic budget. It's not part of the athletic budget.
It's just part of the general university debt service?
Correct.
Okay. I think you know what I'm asking, though, but I don't know if you could have that stuff. I don't know if you've got all your financials done by the end of January. Maybe second quarter would be more appropriate for that type of.
What I could do is I could show you what our revenues and expenses were directly related to football only, in like 06, our last year of AA, 07, 08, 09, and show you a progression of revenues and expenses associated with football. It's hard for us to unravel donations, annual giving. You know, it's up, but you know, so is basketball. I mean, we've gone to a Sweet 16, and we've gone to almost another Sweet 16. So there's a lot. It's all part of the same base of the foundation of a successful athletic program. It's hard to maybe pinpoint where some revenue sources can be attributed.
Maybe a bigger report then. Again, it sounds like second quarter would be far more appropriate, maybe after the end of basketball season, and just sort of a snapshot of where we are, what subsidizes what, you know, just get a really bigger and clear picture of how all this is impacted. This is a really great snapshot of one piece of the puzzle. I just want to see how it all fits together.
Okay. I'll probably call you.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That's great. And I think second quarter probably would be appropriate because you'll want to have the basketball season in the can.
Got it.
Thank you.
Okay.
What is it that you're trying to compare? What is it that you want to look at or see?
Well, you know, I'm just trying to get a sense of what the overall financial picture of this is. And there has been a great deal of expense. And President Ransdell's correct that it's not charged against athletics necessarily. The debt service is on the university budget. I'm just trying to get a sense of the big picture about what costs what takes money from what money goes to what. Just try to get a general big picture, because
you know, people ask, you know, and say, why isn't there money for this? There seems to be money for that. It's much easier to do that and, you know, to execute my fiduciary responsibilities if I have a really clear picture, you know, a nice roadmap. And this is a great part of the picture. We can see how this one piece is growing. But we know in athletics that certain programs subsidize others. That's the way it is. The ones that have gate and have big revenue subsidize the smaller ones that don't work that way. Just want to try to understand how it organically fits together.
Well, I will
But you know, if I could make a comment, I'm not sure that we can measure the contribution of the athletic department to the university in terms of dollars and cents. I mean, we get a budget, we see the figures, we see the numbers, we know what we're spending. I think, you know, the board can decide whether that's wise expenditures and has some control over that, but, you know, I don't think it's measurable as such. Yeah, are you with me?
This is the 10th year that I've been at WKU, and the first year or two, we were in a deficit, and I inherited an athletic department that
right.
was running a deficit.
Right.
The last 8 years, we've been able to balance our budget and build a modest reserve to prevent against future deficits. So we've been able to grow our revenues while our expenses have also grown. But for the last 8 years, we've again balanced our budget and are doing a very good job of increasing private giving and all the revenue variables that go into supporting an athletic department.
Well, as an example of not being able to define what athletics brings to the university as far as dollars and cents, 2 years ago we got into the Sweet 16. What kind of notoriety could have come to Western other than that? I mean, look at. You don't know how many students we got from that. What kind? So it's hard to come up with as Jim Johnson said, a dollar and cent thing. But the fact that you've had balanced the budget for the last 8 out of 10 years, it's pretty doggone good for a school. What we have done and progressed from AA to 1A. And I'm not positive that I'm getting into what Pat is talking about, but I know that's what some of your contemporaries are asking. Well, you know, we can't have this, but they got that. But
it's, you're also trying to get into the things that you can't see on the budget. In the publicly published budget, HAF isn't on there. I mean, WKU Foundation isn't on there either. You know, just trying to get a really big, you know, a big picture of what funds what has grown
what you want, you'd have to list all. You'd have to also talk about all the intangibles.
We can get line item revenues and expenses.
A 2 or 3 page financial summary
sure.
of the athletic budget.
Sure.
But,
and I mean, it's hard to gauge intangibles all along. I mean, we gauge we talk about whether, you know, we can't really talk about led to greater growth either, but. You know, we talk about what's grown, and we give our best guess as to what encourages people to come.
We'll get it.
Daryl can put your athletic budget on paper and show how revenues and expenses balance.
Are you saying that for the January or the April or March?
I actually think that it would probably get a fuller picture. I think it'd be April, I guess. The board meeting is in April. And that way, maybe, depending on when our meeting is, basketball season would be over with, and you'd have a little bit more sense what
you're going to do in October. It's on a fiscal year basis.
Yeah, I mean, it really doesn't matter.
You wouldn't have any more data in April than you'll have now
in terms
of a fiscal year. So just do a budget summary, revenues and expenses. You and Ann can put that together.
Okay. We can do it. The last half of my report, I think everyone has this booklet with them. And I'm not going to go page by page, but I do want to point out a couple facts that I think are important. The title of this book is Championship Effort. That is the kind of the theme that we operate by within WKU Athletics. We ask a championship effort of all of our student athletes, our coaches, our administration, our donors, our sponsors. And if we all give a championship effort, the type of results that we've been achieving will be made possible. On page 3, the 2-year period that we've just completed this past season, the year before, WKU teams won 19 total team championships over the last 2 years. That's more than any other 1A school in the country. There's a grid on the bottom of that page. WKU's won 19 championships in 2 years. BYU has won 18.
Notre Dame has won 17, Texas has won 13, Virginia 12, runs down the list. So you can see the type of company that we're keeping with the type of success that we've been able to enjoy as Sun Belt Conference member institution. So we're very pleased with that, obviously. On page four, we're certainly riding a wave of success. We have set the bar for the standard of success in the Sun Belt Conference. WKU owns 3 years of the best number of overall championships with 10 in 07, 08. That was last year. 9 this year. And then we had 7 in 05, 06. Those are the highest 3 years of Sun Belt Conference championships ever in the 33-year history of the Sun Belt Conference. On page 5, in the last 10 years, WKU teams have won 65 regular season and tournament championships. To put that in comparison, Middle Tennessee is second with 38. South Alabama is third with 32. So we're pretty much doubling up the competition when it comes to the number of championships. So great, great results. Total dominance, really, by WKU teams within the Sun Belt Conference. In the last 8 years, we finished first or second in the Bubas Cup, which measures the best overall intercollegiate athletic program in the Sun Belt Conference. On page 6, the WKU academic success. A lot of times you don't hear enough about our academic success, but it truly is going on. 85% of all student athletes who've exhausted their eligibility earn their degree. That's an extremely high number. We talked yesterday about how many students graduate in 6 years. You get 5 years of eligibility. So we're graduating in 5 years, 85% of our student athletes who finish their degrees at WKU, who exhaust their eligibility at WKU. So very, very proud of that. Overall, our 438 student athletes combined for a GPA, overall cumulative GPA of 3.0. 10 of our 19 intercollegiate athletic teams have a cumulative team GPA of 3.0 or better. And just like we want to win the all-sports trophy in the Sun Belt Conference, we also want to win the all-academic trophy. WKU, for the last 5 years, has had more student athletes honored for academic success than any other school in our league. You can see on page 7, our men's basketball team participated in the NCAA tournament this year. WKU men's basketball has 100% graduation rate. And you can see the other teams in the tournament. Butler has a 92%, Duke has an 89%, Carolina 86%, Xavier 82%, going down the list. So certainly WKU is keeping good company and leading the pack when it comes to graduation rate for men's basketball. Our athletic facilities, we've been able to really, really enhance our athletic facilities just as we've done throughout the campus with, you know, our residence halls, with our restaurants, with academic facilities. Certainly high school students buy with their eyes. It's no different for athletics than it is anywhere else on the campus. We've been able to really prop up our athletic facilities and enhance our recruiting both nationally and locally. We talked about men's basketball. The last 2 years we've been to the NCAA tournament. We just received a check from the Sun Belt Conference for $463,000 as a result of our Sweet 16 run 2 years ago. That was a revenue incentive model that the Sun Belt Conference put in play. We hit it the first year it was in play, and we have received a $463,000 check. We'll put that into an endowment to support our men's basketball efforts. We'll also receive a check this coming spring in 2010, that will be about $300,000, a little over $300,000 as a result of our NCAA run this year. Again, we achieved the performance standards that the Sun Belt Conference issued to the member institutions. So we will soon have an endowment of almost $800,000 to support men's basketball as a result of the last 2 years in the NCAA tournament. On page 11, I show you how the football growth is going, both with season tickets, average attendance, and student attendance. Then on page 13, celebrating championships. Our volleyball, our men's basketball, and our baseball teams have both been consecutive years back-to-back to the NCAA tournament. A neat fact is that out of 341 Division I teams in the country, WKU this year finished 88th overall. So in overall success, so we're in the top 25% roughly of all Division I intercollegiate athletic programs with regard to success, ahead of schools like Providence, Rutgers, Pittsburgh, St. John's, South Florida, Memphis, Gonzaga, Air Force, Mississippi State. So we're certainly getting good value for our investment. On page 14, we wanted to highlight some individuals who are making our success possible. 7 of our 19 sports were recognized with All-Americans. Sun Belt Conference Player of the Year, we had 6 out of 18 that were awarded. So one-third of the Player of the Year awards went to WKU student-athletes. Even better, the Sun Belt Conference Coaches of the Year, there were 18 awards given, and 8 of the 18 were given to WKU head coaches. So almost half of the Coach of the Year awards went to WKU head coaches. Eric Jenkins is a young man. If you all don't know him, I hope you get a chance to meet him. He is a WKU graduate twice. He ran track for us, came here from Florida. He's now our head coach. He followed Curtis Long. He has been our head track and field coach for about 2 years. During that time, he's had a chance to be our head coach for 10 championships, and he's won, his teams have won 9 out of those 10 championships that he's been a head coach. So he's just having phenomenal success. We talk about exposure, visibility. Can you put a dollar value on the media coverage that WKU Athletics generates? We've been able to create a lot of our exposure on our own through kind of a learning laboratory with Hilltopper Sports Satellite Network. As you know, we have the top-ranked broadcast journalism program in the country. That program produces and distributes all of our WKU men's basketball games home and away. We've been able to create a TV network that reaches, every time we are on TV, home or away, over 25 million homes. We have our own station on DirecTV. If you follow WKU Athletics last basketball season, every single time we played, you could turn on 617 on DirecTV, and that was dedicated to WKU men's basketball. Every time we played, it was live on DirecTV, as well as some other stations on Fox College Sports. We invest about $400,000 in that production and in that telecast, but the results that are being generated are far greater than $400,000. And the bulk of the manpower behind that production each game are WKU students. It's led by David Brinkley and individuals in our broadcast journalism school, and most of the people who make it happen are WKU students who get employed by ESPN, Fox Sports, and other networks directly out of WKU as a result of their experience with Hilltopper Sports Satellite Network. So national exposure is terrific. We talk about in-state rivalries. We have a 4-year deal with Louisville in basketball, 4-year deal with Kentucky in football. You can see the growth of Hilltopper Athletic Foundation. We've been able to build a $6 million endowment and reserve within our foundation, the Hilltopper Athletic Foundation. And then finally on the back page, page 20, it just illustrates those teams who've won the championships in the last 2 years. So this has been a phenomenal run, certainly the last couple years. We want to see it going. We want to keep it going. It's hard because everybody's shooting for us. Everybody's coming in here and measuring our facilities. You know, they're looking at, you know, how we're doing things, and it's always hard to stay on top. But that's our goal. We have great coaches, great student athletes, and we wouldn't be successful if it was not for the Board of Regents and the support that we've received from all of you all. And we realize that our success is a direct relation to the value that you all place on WKU Athletics.
Excellent, Wood. We're really proud of the athletic program in every aspect. We think about the football and the basketball and all, but the other sports are really serving us well, and we're really proud of them as well.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
We measure the value of the marketing. If I understood the numbers correctly, we had that marketing presentation yesterday at the Ag Center. If I understood the numbers correctly, and I may have misunderstood them, so I don't want to go on the record on this, but I think this university spends less per year on marketing than each car dealership in Bowling Green spends on marketing. And if that's true, that is an awesome job. Pardon me? I We've really cut back, but but I think we're still spending far more than you are, and that's because of the tremendous job. And a lot of our marketing is done through the academic program. And then the other thing you'd have to measure also is how many of the minority students. If I'm looking at these pictures, I see about half of them that are achieving so well and getting all these awards and everything that may not get to finish school or may not get to attend school. But I see a high presence of minorities, and you have to measure that.
Right.
And the minority presence on campus and what that says about this university and its diversity. And that's immeasurable. So there's a lot of what the athletic department does that we just cannot measure in dollars and cents, as long as you guys are giving us good accounting, which you do.
Right. What do you think? Kevin had a question.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say just two quick things. You know, I enjoyed seeing, I always like to see Western stature, you know, and national sort of things. So there's just two little things he left out. One was about himself, about serving on the NCAA Women's Basketball Committee. That just sounded like it was a really cool opportunity to gain us some respect. And then the second one I saw there was just, I know that's a student, Patrick Jenkins. He's a friend of mine, and just seeing that, I didn't even know he was doing that. He's a really humble, very motivated student, you know, going to med school. And so to see him, you know, there's only 31 individuals, you know, of all the student athletes and all the people who want to be student athletes nationwide. I just thought that was, you know, really exemplary and really cool to see that a Western student was able to be in that position.
That's on page 12. Patrick Jenkins is a cross-country athlete, and there's one student athlete from each of the 31 conferences in the country who are designated on a student athlete advisory committee. They're kind of the feedback, the sounding board for all of athletics administration on what we're doing right, what we might need to improve from the eyes of student athletes. So Patrick Jenkins represents the Sun Belt Conference and is one of 31 student athletes nationally on that board.
Before you put this book up, turn to page 17 real quick. Page 7, excuse me. Page 7. Their academics. You see a photograph of a young man named Matt Rice. In my opening convocation, I'm going to highlight a few students. One of the students I'm going to highlight is this young man. He hit safely in 55 of 61 games. If you think about baseball, that's impossible. Right, Richard?
Absolutely.
He had a 31-game hitting streak, set a Sun Belt Conference record. Hit right at 400 batting average, unheard of in college baseball. He's got a 4.0 GPA. An academic All-American major in mechanical engineering. He is maybe our best engineering student. I don't want to say that because we've got some great ones, but he's among them.
I'd like to highlight one thing that was...
Never made a B in his life.
I'd like to highlight one thing, what's said that probably isn't recognized by an awful lot of people, and that is the opportunities for our students in broadcasting and journalism and in sport management. Work with our athletic programs. For those of you that listened to some of our football games last fall, a young man who did one of the, I'm not sure he was a color commentary, but he did a lot of the on-field interviews, and he did a terrific job of one of our students. So the success of our athletic programs makes it a wonderful medium laboratory for our students, and that's what's been happening.
We
went all the way around athletics as well as
academics.
Well done, Wood.
Thank you.
1 year.
Yeah, 1 year to prove it.
It'll work right now. Get on the stick.
Matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, I ran into and talked with Courtney Lee. Mm-hmm. And he was very disappointed to leave Orlando, but he's going to try to make the most of being in New Jersey. And he was just wanted to know everything that was going on at WKU. And, you know, just he's a good example of putting Western's name out there, because all during the playoffs and that Orlando was in, they'd always say Courtney Lee from Western Kentucky and WKU. And there's some more advertising that you can't pay for.
That's right. Huge in his rookie season to go to the NBA Finals,
yeah,
and start for that team, and here again. Other business, Mr. Chair, I want to point out three of these dates to you. CPE President Bob King, who has been on board for several months now, will be making his first visit to WKU, and it's I've been pressing him to get here and understand what we're about as an institution.
You know that Bob King was hired most notably as being chancellor of the State University of New York system earlier in his career. And he will be here, and we will have a dinner on August 12 at our Center for Research and Development. And we'll have community leaders in that at that dinner, and that'll be a way to introduce him to what we're doing in the way of our research efforts and our Center for Research and Development. But you all will get a notice about that, and it's not a command performance by any means, but I would like to have as many of you as practical or possible there as we introduce Bob King to our campus. And then I'll follow up with an email, but I hope many of you can attend the opening convocation on August 24. That'll be at 8 a.m. in Diddle Arena. We're going to have to do it in Diddle Arena one more year until we get back into Van Meter, but at any rate, our opening convocation will be that Monday morning. If at all possible, Freddie and Rob may have already left. I'd like to introduce you all to our faculty, staff, population, if you all can make it that morning. And then the Council on Post-Secondary Education will meet here on September 10 and 11, but specifically on the evening of September 10, we'll have a dinner at our home for CPE board members, council members, the CPE staff, and you all will be invited to that dinner with the CPE, with the council members. That evening, and then the annual Governor's Trustee Conference is on the 11th at the Plaza here in Bowling Green University Plaza. You'll get invitations from CPE about that. But they come in earlier, and we'll have our opportunity to communicate what we're doing as an institution to the council, and then entertain the council that evening before. So more information to come on September 10 and 11.
The CPE conference is going to be here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, September 10 and 11. On campus on the 10th in the Kentucky building, and then our home, and then on the 11th out of the plaza. The actual CPE meeting and the governor's trustee conference will be at the plaza on the 11th.
You'll be putting that out for information back to us.
Yes. We'll get more detail on that out to you.
I just had a quick note. I know that trustee conference is happening on the 11th, and because of that, I sit on a board of student body presidents. It's all the student body presidents in public university state of Kentucky, and we'll be having a meeting on the 12th there, and so we're going to try to really wow them. If anybody has any good ideas or interesting things to do, or if you all would like to meet some of these student body presidents, some very impressive individuals. Just kind of a really cool opportunity we'll be doing there.
On the
same day as the
12th.
South Florida game. So
busy.
Is it South Florida football, home football game too?
Yeah.
Let me know when and where.
Will do.
Anna, do you have something?
One quick item, because we won't see you till October. I wanted to let you know that the services center is quite aware of what the CDC is saying about H1N1.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're doing everything. What the availability will be on the vaccine. Young people, which is defined as under 24, are on the list of priorities. We have some folks that will probably be working with representatives from the government. The University of Louisville is going to host a summit for higher education institutions and some state workers readiness. So please understand that we've got an emergency management team. And in addition to your basic understanding of the vaccine, which is still being tested, there's differing opinions about whether it's ready for distribution. But we'll also be doing student wellness and promoting those things that are equally important, hand washing and health etiquette. But I just wanted to take that 30 seconds to let you know that we are aware of it, and
Is this something that will be included in the student orientation when they first come to campus, or will you wait until it's closer to time?
I would say more or less student orientation has happened as we do through ATP. But we have a lot of mechanisms to be able to communicate with the campus and
and we will do that as we think we have important information.
Well, I think, you know, the signs of wash your hands and all that should start out immediately.
Actually, with the master plan program, I assume we're doing some things like that. I'm looking at Dean and looking at Barbara, and I'm not sure who else I'm supposed to be looking for, but Brian and Howard.
I know that they have a whole bunch of different topics, and I know that the health and wellness folks have a lot of, you know, sessions that they provide at that. I know they do alcohol awareness and STD awareness and safe dating, and I would be surprised if they don't have something on that. But I'll mention to Libby Greeny. I'll just give proper note.
Thank you, Ann. That's all I got.
Okay, next committee meeting October 2nd, next quarterly board meeting October 3rd. Do I have a motion that we, October 30th, I mean, excuse me.
I move to adjourn.
All right.
Second.
Second.
Yeah.